Hello and welcome to Alzheimer's Talks. My name is Meryl Comer and I'm the co-founder of Women Against Alzheimer's and chair of the Global Alliance on Women's Brain Health. As a founding board member of Us Against Alzheimer's, I'm pleased to be hosting the rollout of a new webcast format of our popular call-in show, Alzheimer's Talks. Beginning with this session, we have some exciting changes. We'll start each program with news and other updates before diving into our featured conversation with leading experts from our new Brain Health Partnership and, of course, hearing from researchers that are so important to us all. Today, we'll be interviewing healthcare and aging expert Anne Tomlinson, and we'll take a look at being proactive around brain health across the age and the steps we need to take to begin reducing our risk for developing Alzheimer's and how we stave off cognitive decline. The other big issue, of course, is how the healthcare system has to get ready for the first disease-modifying therapy. But first, let's take a look at what's happening in the Alzheimer's space. In the news, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, that's CMS, the federal agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid, has announced that starting in 2020, they will begin authorizing significant payments for Medicare Advantage beneficiaries who have been diagnosed with dementia. That's a long time in coming, and these payments will create new incentives for our healthcare system to assess and diagnose patients with dementia. As you know, currently 50% of people with dementia go undiagnosed. It will also enforce the documentation of all dementia diagnosis in patient medical records, which is also very critical. On the legislative side, Congress has introduced two important pieces of legislation. Remember the Change Act and the Younger Onset Alzheimer's Act. The Change Act takes a targeted approach to addressing the Alzheimer's crisis by encouraging early detection, diagnosis, and access to interventions. In conjunction with the new CMS rule I mentioned earlier, it will help foster early diagnosis. An important benefit is that as more people are diagnosed earlier, we could see a clinical increase in clinical trial participation, so badly needed if we are going to accelerate a disease sort of cure. It also gives us more shots on goal. Us Against Alzheimer's work very closely with members of Congress to draft, introduce, and advance the Change Act. Remember the name of the act and thank your representative who voted for it. Also recently introduced in Congress, the Younger Onset Alzheimer's Act would provide much needed relief for some 200,000 Americans under the age of 60 who have early onset Alzheimer's by ensuring they have access to programs and services. My husband had early onset Alzheimer's, and of course, in those days, go back 20 years, there was nothing to support us. We were left on our own. So, again, pay attention to the legislation coming through and the work that we're doing on your behalf. And of course, we are tracking the money. We need money to make things happen. Research front, Bill Gates has emerged as a powerful supporter in the fight against Alzheimer's. He has come out to announce that his father had Alzheimer's. And I think once you've seen it, you know that you want to engage and do something about it. Recently, he, along with Jeff and Mackenzie Bezos of Amazon, doubled down on their commitment by making a $30 million contribution to the Alzheimer's Drug Discovery Foundation's Diagnostic Accelerator. So scientists are rapidly looking at Alzheimer's biomarkers with the goal of someday being able to diagnose Alzheimer's with a blood test before symptoms appear. And again, the earlier we get to it, the earlier we can intervene. The Gates Foundation leadership in this space is always welcomed, and we hope that it will expand early diagnosis. Last week, Americans of every faith took time to contemplate and worship in their own way on National Prayer Day. And from an Us Against Alzheimer's survey of our A-list community of 6,000 patients and caregivers and former caregivers, we do know that faith is an important part of the Alzheimer's journey for patients and their families. 74% of those who have faced the challenges of Alzheimer's and dementia or mild cognitive impairment say they have been fully or partially sustained by their faith. Also this May, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and mental health is an important component of brain health. In another survey of our A-list community, caregivers share the way they deal with the stress and emotions that come with caregiving. Nearly a quarter say they exercise, participate in therapy, or get support from their friends and family. And again, spirituality was another important marker for them. If you're a caregiver looking for support, go to Facebook and search for Us Against Alzheimer's Community. And if you're interested in sharing what matters most to you, visit alistforresearch.org. That's A-List, A-L-I-S-T, the number 4.org. You'll be amazed at what we're doing. In fact, this week we are actually looking at the role reversal on Mother's Day in celebrating the ones we love. Last week, thousands of women spent a month taking part in the Be Brain Powerful 30-Day Brain Health Challenge to improve their cognitive vitality. My favorite challenge of the month was learn something new or revisit something you've learned. I revisited my four years of college French by going on Babbel. I didn't do so well, but it made me understand that it was time to keep moving. Spirit of March Madness, USA Today followers on Twitter voted on their favorite ways to stay brain healthy. In the finals, we had a matchup between sleeping well and our child was the runaway. So we are going to now move to introduce our guest, Anne Tomlinson. Anne's an expert in healthcare and aging, and she conducts research and advises policymakers and business leaders on issues like long-term care, and has testified before Congress and contributed to leading journals. And Anne's research, of course, like so many of us, is grounded in real-life experiences through the caregiving community she founded, called Daughterhood.org, which is a nationwide network of caregivers who help each other navigate the health and elder care system. As always, we will be taking your questions. Please note, we cannot take personal medical questions. Otherwise, if you're watching on Facebook Live, you can type your questions in the comments. Please let us know who you are, where you're from. And if you're watching on Zoom, please submit your questions in the comment box, and we'll get to as many questions as possible. And thank you for joining us today, and thank you for the work that you've done on our behalf. You released a new paper on the Brain Health Partnership led by Us Against Alzheimer's on creating what is viewed as an optimal system of brain health care. Now, can you tell us what's been going on before and what optimal looks like?
Well, I think we can all agree we're not in an optimal system right now, in the sense that there's still so much ignorance among the sort of healthcare community, the healthcare provider community, about what it really means to be brain healthy and the opportunities to do that throughout the lifetime. And I put myself even in that category, because before I started working on this project, I realized I had a lot of preconceived notions about Alzheimer's disease and cognitive impairment, even though I've worked on this for, you know, these issues more generally for 30 years, that there's really a lot that we can do to improve the way that we approach brain health throughout the lifetime. So the idea is that we really could set up kind of a system of care that would attempt to kind of protect and enhance brain function throughout the lifetime. That there are opportunities to begin working on and addressing brain health you know, from the moment you're born until the moment you die, that this isn't just something, dementia is not just a disease of old age. It's brain health is the larger issue that we should all be focused on, and we can be working on it throughout our life. And so what that really means is there's sort of four parts. The way I think about it anyway, I'm interested in how others think about it, but that there's first and foremost, just always having a focus on the opportunity to optimize brain health. So you can optimize your cognitive function through a lot of different kinds of interventions. And like some of the things that, you know, you hear from others about, like sleep and diet and exercise, but also that there's an important component of an optimal system of brain health that focuses on prevention of disease as well. So that's being very careful to watch for risk factors that you might personally or individually be developing that could actually increase your risk for dementia later on, and then address those. And then there's kind of two other pieces. One is, as much as possible, to begin to sort of detect and diagnose cognitive impairment and decline as early as possible. And I think this is where we fall down the most. I mean, most people don't want to know. Providers don't want to talk about it. We don't have a healthy kind of attitude towards the opportunity to improve and delay cognitive impairment. And then finally, even when you have full-blown dementia, there's opportunities to improve brain health. It's not just like something you walk away from. You can still increase your functioning, increase your engagement, and address issues around brain health, even if you have a disease of the brain. And so, you know, the idea of the optimal brain health system is one that looks across all of those different elements and addresses our opportunity to improve cognitive function, you know, across the whole lifespan.
I think what I really hear is that we've been taking our brain for granted and assumed that our brain span would match our lifespan, and unfortunately that is not the case with longevity. The other issue that is striking to me is that we are not ready for success. We worry about failures in research, but if you really think about it, if we had a disease-modifying therapy, the assessment backup would be almost 2 years. So uncovering that kind of research that says you have to wait in line for 2 years, that's too long by any measure if you're trying to get a diagnosis and get it early.
Right, exactly. Like we can't address what we don't know about. So even if we have the most fantastic, intervention of pharmaceutical intervention or other kinds of interventions, we can't actually apply it if we don't have a system that supports the application. We don't have the way to find people who have the disease and help them early. Then, you know, it's all kind of for nothing. So it's like it's an incredibly, you know, one thing that this project has taught me is that this is probably kind of as important as the disease modifying drugs and that kind of work. These things have to go hand in hand. We can't do one without the other.
It was striking to me that for many of these doctors, it takes about 15 years. You're the expert, but I've heard that it takes about 15 years to change physicians' behavior. Well, we're all out of time in most of our minds. So I think the Change Act and some of the other legislative incentives that are coming forward may be helpful in making them more deliberate about talking to families in a very honest and direct way.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that we found in our research is that one of the reasons why physicians are not inclined to talk to families and patients in a direct way is because they themselves don't necessarily feel like they have good solutions to offer. Mm-hmm. And they feel this, you know, it's like, you know, they feel sort of nervous about bringing up something if they don't feel confident that they can offer a solution. And so, you know, a big part of what we have to do is to put solutions in the hands of physicians, give them the tools that they need to do brain health checkups. Everybody should have a checkup from the neck up kind of thing. And that if there are issues, that the physician feels confident to say, hey, here's a message of hope for you and your family. These are things that you can do to address your brain health. Here's a set of services and supports that you can access. And you know, we have to increase their level of confidence, or they're going to just try to ignore this as much as they can. So that's
and
a
I
huge
think we have to push, we also have to push the conversation, Ann, because they have 10 minutes, and if they're managing another comorbidity like hypertension or diabetes, that's those 10 minutes. But it's really incumbent upon us to step forward and say, well, I'm feeling different. We know how we feel, and we have to be vocal about that. I think it's up to us to push the issue and try to override their reluctance.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because that was the second thing that emerged in our research, was that there, you have to almost imagine that there's kind of a push and a pull in the system that has to happen. So we do need providers to have a better solution set available to them so that they will feel more confident, but we also have to increase what we call the demand for attention on this issue in the doctor's office and in the public sphere. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of folks who are doing a lot of work to educate consumers more about the opportunity to improve brain health. But what we recommended in this report and what we learned in our research was that there's still more opportunities to help consumers have a really productive conversation with their physicians. And when we start going into the office and saying, I'm concerned about this, I'm interested in this, if enough of us do that, then the physicians go, okay, oh my gosh, you know, we've got to be able to respond and make them more proactive. So it is a two-way street. We've got to be more engaged, and we need them to be more confident to help us.
The other thing is, you mentioned the importance of diet and exercise and learning a language or doing something different. But I just read some fascinating statistics about the largest number of centenarians are in Japan. And what really drove that change was the fact that through government edicts, they reduced the amount of salt that people were permitted in their diets and in food. And that's why today they have the largest number of those 100 plus in the world. So can change things, but we have to pay attention and be disciplined about it. I think right. That's the other thing that's striking to me is, you know, we understand with our kids that they need a cognitive baseline for sports. And as adults, we know that's for prevention. Why aren't we doing the same for us? That's our baseline, and we need to know. You have three major recommendations to build a brain healthcare system. What have you come down with?
So we have three things that if we feel like if we could focus on these things, we could really make a big difference really quickly. And the first one is, we're trying to address three different points in the system. One is the healthcare providers themselves and elevating and creating the solutions and tools that they need to be having these conversations so they feel confident. We want to increase their confidence and boost the likelihood that they're going to engage in these conversations. And just to kind of take a quick sidetrack on that, you know, you mentioned lifestyle factors and the fact that a doctor maybe only has 30, you know, 20 minutes or 10 minutes. So many of these other diseases that they're paying attention to are related to brain health. So part of giving them the confidence to have a conversation with somebody about their brain and the health of their brain is to help them to understand that when they address hypertension, you know, to your point about salt, you know, when you address cardiovascular diseases, you are in fact not just helping the heart or the circulatory system, but you're also helping the brain. And, you know, I think that if we can give the physicians that kind of information, makes them feel more confident. That was one of our major sort of action areas that we elevated for the community of folks working on Alzheimer's disease, is that this is going to make a really big difference. The second thing is, again, helping them on the push and the pull side, is helping the consumers, you know, elevating for them the importance, their role in the healthcare system of advocating for brain health and asking. So, you know, it makes me, when we, you know, the AIDS movement or the hospice movement, I mean, there have been all of these consumer-driven movements in healthcare that have changed the healthcare system from the bottom up. So it's a grassroots, we want to enable that grassroots kind of individual advocacy within the healthcare system. So that's the second area. And then thirdly, we have to make the business of healthcare align with the things that we want to accomplish. And right now, our healthcare system is really concerned with, you know, what happens today, what happens this year. It's not set up to reward healthcare insurers or providers for doing things today that are going to make a difference many years from now. Mm-hmm. So we've got to find new ways of rewarding, incentivizing, and making kind of the business case really strong for the organizations that get paid, you know, either to ensure our health or to provide us healthcare services. So those are the three action areas that we identified in the report that where we think we could get some traction and move this along.
Well, I'm not here to stump you, but I do want to ask, so many insurers have gotten out of long-term care. Now, I'm a lady with two long-term care policies because I take care of two loved ones at home with Alzheimer's. Yep. And I do a 12-hour shift. I know the cost of care.
Yeah. So,
and people held on to their insurance. The insurance companies thought there'd be a 15% default rate, and guess what? That didn't happen. So now that's the biggest payout for insurers. So how do we rethink that system and make sure that people get the coverage?
That is an issue I've been working on my whole career. And so I'm glad you asked that question. Do we have an hour?
We'll invite you back. Right.
honestly, what we, the chat, one of the most important things, the problem with long-term care insurance is it's very expensive. So very few people can really afford it. One of the reasons why it's so expensive is actually because of the high cost of Alzheimer's disease. If we can do things to create an optimal system of brain health, to increase health span in the population overall, increase brain health span. So even if you're at risk for Alzheimer's disease and you get it later in life, like later in that lifespan, or you minimize the impact of it, that we reverse mild cognitive impairment when we can, all of those things that we can do to live healthier will actually make long-term care insurance less expensive for the overall population. So it's incredibly important what we're trying to do in this space so that we can protect, you know, kind of the few people who will face that no matter what, against that risk. And we have to all participate. So this is a very touchy subject, but mathematically it doesn't work for five people to buy an insurance plan. Everybody has to be in the insurance system. So the government has a role to play in making sure that everybody eventually has the ability to access this insurance and does it.
Well, we want to make sure that we open the lines and make it available to everyone who is listening in. And we have questions that have been submitted in advance by listeners. And for those of you who want to participate, please type in your comments. Here's a question from Claire in Travis County, Texas. Is there anything a 77-year-old can do to delay or stop Alzheimer's? I say, Claire, get an attitude. Say you're going to do it. 77 is young today, isn't it, man?
Yeah, so first of all, that's a great question to be asking yourself. I'm 51. I'm asking myself that same question all the time. And so, absolutely. So the good news is absolutely. Like I said, you know, work with your doctor, and I'm not a medical person, but, you know, have that conversation with your doctor about what you can be doing. And then all of the things that you know, you're probably, because asking the question, probably is already doing lots of things that are healthy, but, you know, exercise is the absolute number one. When we looked at the research and we were looking for where the hardcore evidence was, exercise, cardiovascular exercise is the most important thing, and sleep that you can do to protect your brain.
Yeah, I love that recommendation, and I do believe it's great for you. But then at 65, your knees begin going, your back, you know, to do enough exercise to really get the lift. I always wonder whether we're going to make it. Here's another question from Mary in Mesquite, Texas. Texas, we're glad you're on the line. What brain health test do you foresee being administered, and will insurance pay? You know, a lot of people benefit. Every night, I know you shouldn't do it before you go to bed, but I play brain games first thing in the morning and late at night to see how much I miss based on what I do in the morning. But I just think it's reinforcing to pay attention that way. What have you found?
Well, we had such an interesting conversation. So just as a quick background, when we put this paper together, we had, you know, our process for going through this, or pulling all of this research together really was to interview all of the experts and then to bring everybody around in a big, you know, day-long meeting to have discussions about all of this. And one of the things that was most exciting to me was that there's an enormous amount of kind of work and research that's being done, particularly for veterans, around really being able to do that kind of daily brain check. So I guess to answer the question, in the future, I think that we will all have access to fairly sophisticated, advanced sort of self-administration of, you know, a questionnaire that we can quickly kind of go through and check off and respond to kind of check where we are from a brain health perspective. So, you know, I think
I love that, by the way. I keep thinking of, they're going to come up with what I call the mobile mirror that sort of gives you some numbers on yourself, and you say, okay, maybe I better get the doctor's appointment, or maybe I better work out. It's sort of like a trigger that gets us involved and much more engaged in our own health.
Yeah, and I think that one of the challenges that came up in this conversation we were having with the experts was, I think people are really excited and motivated to check their brain health if they have the perspective that what they're trying to do is really improve and optimize and make their brain even healthier. I think when you frame it as like, we're going to check for disease, then people become scared because it's a frightening prospect to be losing cognitive function. And so I think we all have to kind of take the perspective that what we're really doing always is checking in to see if there are things that we need to be doing to improve our functioning, like things that are under our control. So like sleeping, eating right, exercise, and things like that.
You know, in preparing for the paper, did you look at genetic risks like APOE4 and its impact, Joe?
We didn't actually. We were really much more focused on lifestyle risk and the risk and the relationship of other diseases to this disease. And so, you know, that there, and I think one of the things that came out though in the research is that there, dementia is a very multifaceted kind of set of, it really covers a lot of different kinds of, it manifests in many different kinds of ways. And it, so there's a subsection of people who have dementia or risk for dementia for whom it can be impacted. And then there may be some for whom it won't be. But, you know, we have so much more work that we could be doing to improve the brain health system overall so that we can really address it where we can address it.
Well, I have a recruit for us. Hope in Boston asks, what can I do to help create an optimal system of brain health care in my community? Let's get it down to the nitty gritty. We have someone who's ready to get ready.
Oh my gosh, I love that question. Well, because you know, so much of what we're going to accomplish in the healthcare system and the long-term care system and the, you know, the brain health piece of all of this is going to be done at the community level. And so I think that working with you know, the healthcare providers, and there's like a number of different ways that you could promote this within your community. But I think reaching out to the different kinds of community centers, community hubs, where do people come together in your community and and start to have, just to simply have the conversation and elevate for people that this is in fact something that is addressable and can be impacted, and encouraging everybody to begin to have that conversation with the healthcare providers. I mean, I think maybe one of the first things that I would do is engage with a healthcare system and a physician group and try to kind of create a partnership in bringing people in the community together with them to sort of map out a strategy, increasing the opportunity to be outside and to exercise and in communal spaces, reducing social isolation, giving people ways to engage. I think there's so many different things that you can do at the community level.
I did hear of a group, Hope You're in a Book Club. A lot of book clubs are now taking the literature on being healthy and issues of depression and menopause and all the issues that impact our health. And eventually, a lot of it comes from our brain. I mean, most of us don't know that for those of us who may get hot flashes, that's from the brain. That's the trigger. So we're learning more, and the brain is just fascinating. And the differences between men and women, sex-based differences in the disease become more and more important as the science teases it out. You know, we know that women are two-thirds the victims, two-thirds the caregivers, but also that if it's on the maternal side, my mother is 85, and we've had her at my house for about 10 years. If it's on the maternal side, my risk is higher as her daughter. If it's on the paternal side, your risk is better, improved. And the other thing we've learned is that at any age, the brain has plasticity. It may be a little slower in how it engages, but in fact, we can do things. And I'm not a scientist. I'm just a noisy advocate. And so we follow the science. And I think that's the other thing. As advocates, we want to stay close to the science, and we want to see how we can be most helpful. Another question. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Are you optimistic for those advocating for an end to Alzheimer's and those who are living it from day to day? What view do we have?
Well, I am very optimistic that we will end Alzheimer's. I think it's just a matter of time. I think that, unfortunately, though, for people who are living it, feel like they don't have that kind of time. And so, and, you know, Meryl, I think you could probably speak to this better than anybody, but finding ways in your own life, if you're taking care of somebody or if you have a family member with Alzheimer's or if you have Alzheimer's, to look for hope and optimism is challenging. I mean, I think it's important for us not to pretend like it isn't really just incredibly hard. And I was going to say earlier about caregivers and family relationships that you were talking about is that, so just to kind of put a really fine point on it, if you have an increased risk for Alzheimer's because of these familial relationships and heredity, it's even more important as the caregiver to figure out ways to reduce the stress. So that's where we have the opportunity to impact the progression of the disease is how, and this is the thing that I'm so passionate about and I guess I'm optimistic about, which is that I see this incredibly rapidly growing recognition of the role of caregivers in our society, taking care of older adults and frail older adults and people with dementia. And I think we're going to, you know, as a country, we're going to, you know, very shortly have lots and lots more supports and services and help for caregivers. And that's kind of another way to create an optimal system of brain health is to help caregivers keep their brains healthy.
You know, I think because the disease so interrupts generations and children and grandchildren feel so helpless in the space, of their own brains or feeling that they can do something, to me is very empowering and so important. And I do think women, because we are two-thirds the caregivers, we can be on mission about being brain powerful, what that looks like, and being the chief medical officers in the family, as we like to say. You know, thank you, Anne, for everything you've done and your time. I know it's fascinating research, and now we have to go take that research up on the hill and make a difference with it. So thank you for your dedication to the work. That's all the time we have for today. So thank you for joining us. And we do have actually copies of the materials and the report that you released. So if people are interested, they can certainly find it on Us Against Alzheimer's. I think it's available on our site. We'll look forward to talking with you again and catching up. Thank you, Anne, for joining us.
Thank you.
And before we wrap up, we have one last important request. Last week, Us Against Alzheimer's chairman and co-founder George Vredenburg spoke at the Milken Institute Global Conference. And there he made an important brain health announcement. He called for an annual checkup from the neck up to be a routine for all ages, Americans of all ages. And that, in fact, was an announcement that coincided with the release of the paper that Anne and I have been talking about today. So now we're going to ask you to take some action. Head over to our Facebook or Twitter pages and take your pledge to ask your doctor about your brain health at your next checkup. Try it. See how it feels. You're healthy. Why not? Say, what can I do to improve my health? And we'll find out that for each of us asking, they have to pay attention if we ask in numbers. So thank you again. Us Against Alzheimer's, We Want a Flag, goes on the road with courageous conversations. I was just most recently in Chicago, led by a fellow board member, Karen Siegel, and we had a great turnout. So we leave you today with a few photos of people who are joining us and getting on board. They have committed to the 30-day brain health challenge. So let's take a look and see how they perform for the camera in making their pledge. Until next time, I'm Meryl Comer, and this has been Alzheimer's Talk.